Welcome to the Fearless Podcast. In a time of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the Fearless Podcast. We are at episode 20.
Episode 20.
Yeah. And like I've been telling y'all, I've had some awesome guests lined up, and today you will not be disappointed. We have Matthew Arrett on the podcast. Hey, Matthew, how you doing, sir?
Hey, guys, I'm doing great. I'm really happy to be here with you.
So what happened is I'm subscribed to your Substack, and I got an email about your new documentary you're working on, and I was like, this is so cool, because I think it was episode two or three, I think,
really,
of the podcast. You and I were talking about, it was episode three. Are aliens coming to attack or abduct you? Right. Mm-hmm. And basically my premise of that podcast was just how this entire thing is a psychological operation. You know, and a lot of guys, not a lot of guys, I'll say a few guys like Jason Burmis and Jay Dyer have talked at some depth about this thing. But what you're putting together is incredibly thorough and deep, which is why I wanted to have you on. And I thought maybe what we could do is we could watch the trailer. I wanted to make folks aware of this project that you're putting together. I think you're trying to crowdsource for it or fundraise for it. So I thought we could help you at that end. And then we could get in to just a handful of these intricacies of what this is all about. But to start off, how about, Matt, how about you introduce yourself and kind of explain who you are and what you do, and maybe even tell us, how did this whole thing start?
Absolutely. Well, thank you, guys. And yeah, no, I really appreciate this platform and getting just the chance to chat about some of these concepts that are very important to me, but I think to the world. And this project, in brief, came about through what I thought was just a short article and maybe a little video that I was going to make with my wife and my colleague, Jason Dahl, who's an amazing film producer that I met last year during the Trucker Convoy process. And he had his own channel called Super Spreaders, and he had me on. And he said, hey, here's a promo. And I never have anybody who's going to I do a lot of interviews, but I never have anybody who does like a 10-minute promo advertisement for one of the interviews, especially when there's like just a few people. It didn't have a huge viewer base, but I saw this promo and it was like a high quality film production just to promote a little podcast I was going to do in a week. So I was like, wait a minute, you've got skill. And I've been dying to produce documentaries. I went to film school many, many years ago as I was going through my, when my worldview of normieism was breaking down, I was in the middle of university and film school. And I really wanted to just always make multimedia productions, but I didn't quite have the time and the skill set needed, but this guy had it. And so we started working together and we started pumping out some pretty, really, really high-end, in my view, documentaries. I know you guys did a little bit of a deep dive dissection of one of them on Smedley Butler in the attempt to have a banker's coup back in the 30s. But we've done a few. And so I was like, okay, this UFO thing seems to be pretty ubiquitous. And, you know, working in the office in the cubicle experience that I was doing for a few years, you'd hear just coworkers, colleagues, people working in admin, you know, just talking about their belief in UFOs and ghosts and paranormal stuff that they got from TV, from all of these things. And it was weird because it's like, this is becoming normal. It's becoming normalized stuff that you would normally be whispering in maybe 20, 30 years ago in bathrooms or something. You'd be talking with your colleagues and keeping your tone down. All of a sudden it was just becoming more normal. Yeah. And the question was, is this natural that, you know, everybody all of a sudden be fixated on UFOs? I know that there's surveys that have been done regarding the loss of faith over the past 30 years. There's been almost an inversely, just as people's faith in God has diminished over since 1990, the belief in extraterrestrial forces has increased almost to the exact same proportion.
Yeah.
So there's all of these anomalies.
And that actual point, that point is my interest in this topic. You know, we're Christians, and I have exactly seen exactly what you just stated. And there is a direct correlation because it's a replacement. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And the information and the data and the suspects that you're going to weave together, it'll make it blazingly obvious and apparent just by their own words, which I always love people that source their material. And then we know these folks are indicted by what they say. And I think that's very powerful. And you do a great job of doing the deep dive research and then putting all the puzzle pieces together.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, and like I said, the fact that, and what we're going to try to do in the course of this documentary series, and I just to tie up what I said earlier, originally my idea was to have a little short 10-20 minute little video on the Rockefeller Foundation. Cause when you start scratching on some of those who are pushing the Disclosure Project, and it seems like every day when you turn on the news, CNN, whether it's Fox News, CNN, international media, mainstream media is talking about alien disclosure, Pentagon. The Pentagon is leaking material saying that we have, you know, extraterrestrial beings or material from not made by humans. Mm-hmm. None of this stuff is ever proven, but it's all said in almost like a gossipy way, but by the mainstream news media talking about it, by the Congress having whistleblower testimonies. Again, no evidence is ever presented on any of this stuff. It creates a fervor in the zeitgeist to really obsessively focus on this issue. And you look at who are the backers promoting this? What are the agencies who are doing the most like heavy lifting, making this happen? And it doesn't take you long before you start encountering that, oh, you have things like the Lawrence Rockefeller Disclosure Project, which recruited this bodybuilding doctor named Stephen Greer, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was brought in through the Esalen Institute, through the Human Potential Movement, which again was part of this New Age Aquarian conspiracy infiltration of the culture back in the 60s, following disciples of Aldous Huxley. People like Timothy Leary were brought into this idea to remake the entire nature of human beings around something more conducive to a transhumanist type of fascist system of controls. Because the problem was, for a lot of these figures who put a lot of effort into the rise of fascism in the first place, because keep in mind, like that Smedley Butler documentary went through, fascism wasn't just a German, Italian, European phenomenon. It was all over the place, and the money bags behind it involved some of the highest power financial centers in the city of London, the Wall Street complex, the DuPonts, the Rockefellers were massively behind the rise of this thing. The Fort Henry Ford was behind the emergence and the growth, the success story that was fascism in the 1920s, 30s, 40s. And it's not like these creatures who were also sponsoring through the Rockefeller Foundation, the British Eugenic Society, they were also funding pseudosciences, like statistical pseudosciences in the school system, in medical practice, like eugenics, the science of purifying the human species to create a new type of human species around better breeding habits run by people who are ironically very inbred themselves. You know, when you look at the mating habits of the Galtons and the Huxleys and the Darwins and the Wedgwoods, they're all like intermarried, right? And don't even get me started on the royal families above them. Yeah. So it's quite the irony that these are the self-professed over humans who are determining what will be the fit and the unfit.
Yeah.
So they didn't disappear. The bankers behind fascism didn't disappear. That project was a failure, but it didn't. It was not the war to end all wars that we were told. Most of the Nazis were not punished in Nuremberg. Some were, but very few. Most of them were reincorporated, unreconstructed into the Anglo-American security apparatus. Many of them were brought into South America and became leading collaborators with the CIA in the overthrow of a variety of governments in Guatemala and Dominican Republic, in Chile, and became advisors like Klaus Barbie, leading Nazi killer who advised various governments of South America.
Yeah, and what's fascinating as this disclosure process has expanded, so has the CIA documents that Operation Paperclip and all of this activity in Argentina and South America, how that the Nazis weren't defeated, they were just absorbed. That has all come out simultaneously, almost to create cognitive dissonance, I think. I'm not exactly sure exactly why it was done, but it did happen simultaneously.
Yeah, it is. It is interesting. I think you're right. It's almost to diffuse the fact that both of these things are being popularized at the same time. I think partially has a hypnotic effect by getting people to associate all of a sudden something very important about MKUltra, about the incorporation of Nazis into our Western security apparatus at, during the entirety of the Cold War. You know, like we did it. We just recently did a video on the Nazis in NATO and how 8 consecutive high-level Nazis managed the NATO Eastern Command from the 1950s all the way to 1983. One of them was the NATO Secretary General, Heusinger, who was Hitler's top intelligence chief besides Reinhard Gehlen, who became all of a sudden the head of NATO. Reinhard Gehlen, by the way, got the job of setting up the entire German intelligence apparatus with his whole network in the almost immediately after World War II was over by Alan Dulles, right? Yeah. Who puts him to work in West Germany, carrying out the war against commies. And that involves creating terrorist cells like the Red Brigades, who are sold to a gullible, fearful Western population, especially in Europe, as being Marxist-Leninist evildoers. But as we discovered later on, these people who are like launching mailbox bombs, killing people in malls, creating a climate of tension and terror, driving people into the hands of increasingly right-wing governments. And when I say right-wing here, I'm not talking about Donald Trump Republican. I'm talking about like fascist Nazi.
Yes. Yep.
That's a different thing. And, you know, they would then blame it on, they were just basically saying, see, if you just give up a bit of your liberty and get rid of that belief in liberty necessarily the way you used to have it, we're going to give you security against the bomb makers. And this is the prototype for the current sort of what became the continuation of this in the war on terror, especially after the Soviet Union collapsed. So again, you have what seems to be two different things. The UFO disclosure thing, as you said, coming out at the same time as this real history. Who killed JFK? How did this happen through the collusion of Alan Dulles? Major figures within the CIA itself had to play a key role carrying out that inside job before, during, and then after JFK was killed, hiding the truth, the evidence available to anyone with eyes to look at it, of multiple shooters, of a much, much deeper conspiracy within JFK's government. And when you actually, and part of this, the documentary series we're going to go through will involve the anomaly that many of the figures that JFK fired, including Alan Dulles, Charles Cabell, who was the second in command at the CIA, and also Richard Bissell, who was the head of the Office for Policy Coordination, which is sort of the black ops, dirty tricks branch of the CIA that carries out a lot of the assassinations operations of like anytime you want somebody killed, it's through that Office for Policy Coordination set up in 1950. All of these figures who JFK fired, all three guys, the same time he was saying he's going to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it into the winds, that famous statement, that all happened around December 1961.
So the way you direct policy is you just assassinate dissenting voices. Is that how you direct policy, I guess, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, when the rules of the game are not followed by those who are expected to follow, because the way that they see this is a great game, and the great game has
the
rules. That's the idea of the rules-based international order. It just means there's rules that we made, but we don't have to follow them.
Right.
Everybody else does. But when somebody else realizes the game is rigged and they don't follow them, well, what do? Well, you got to go and kill them, and make a demo. But now my interesting point that ties into your question or your observation about the current period is that all of these figures play a prominent role in the cultivation of the UFO cult, the UFO mythos. And here I've got literally, and we have some serious smoking gun material regarding Charles Cabell, directly the one responsible in 1952 for setting up Project Blue Book, the biggest longstanding government-funded UFO research investigation committee in history that went on all the way up until 1968. Charles Cabell puts this into motion, largely following the program that had been set up a little bit earlier by one Sir Henry Tizard. We're going to say something about him in a second. He's so important. People don't even know his name. So important. British high-level lead scientist, the guy who effectively manages and creates the guidelines for what became America's Manhattan Project in 1940, when he came in with a British delegation and trained the American establishment on how to manage science under a controlled, in a controlled manner, under the veil of secrecy, which was, he said, needed during World War II. So you have to have, so we're going to say something about that in a second, because that's going to be important. So you have Charles Cabell, fired by JFK, who was also overseeing the failed Bay of Pigs invasion and many murders of the Guatemalan president, or who was ousted, Dominican Republican president, and a variety. Anyway, so him. You have Alan Dulles, who was fired. Alan Dulles plays a key role also in psychological warfare operations, working with Carl Jung, who is his guru. Mm-hmm. Carl Jung was an agent for the OSS in World War II, carrying out psychological warfare on the people of Germany, but also the people of Europe and America more broadly, which continued after the war. And Carl Jung actually has, I'm reading his book on flying saucers right now. So people know if Carl Jung is a psychiatrist.
Wow.
He actually wrote a crazy book on the modern myth of things seen in the sky, basically as a how-to manual, effectively, for those who know how to read this thing, and Alan Dulles certainly did, on how to use the idea, the concept of UFOs as a way to bring people into a hypnotic trance and to cultivate new stories, new sacred myths for them to believe in. The idea of God can't really hold up in the modern age, so we need something new. Now, Carl Jung is using a somewhat Gnostic Christian language of secret knowledge that he knows, because he's got, you know, the initiated eyes to see what's really in the Bible. And so Alan Dulles is working with him also on this. And you have Richard Bissell, who's, as I said, the head of the OPC, the Office of Policy Coordination, who is also in charge and the founder of Area 51, who's also fired. He's also in charge of the creation and the cultivation of various assassination groups. Later on, Jim Garrison, who carried out one of the only jury trials investigating the conspiracy around Clay Shaw in New Orleans, who was part of an international assassination network to kill JFK in 1966. Jim Garrison was the district attorney for New Orleans. He carried out a deep dive. Now, his investigation was infiltrated by agents from the inside, so it ended up petering out. It was sabotage from within, but he carried out a lot of research after that, one of which pointed out that one of the key shooters, which will come up in our book and video series, who was part of the Grassy Knoll team. There were several photographs of this figure, whose name I'm all of a sudden forgetting, was actually trained in a Mexican-based assassination training area, camp. There's two of them that were masquerading as Christian missionary schools. One had a Catholic missionary brand. The other one was the brand of the Plymouth Brethren. And what's interesting here is that the Plymouth Brethren, if you actually just Google them, they were set up in the 1830s by a figure named Nelson Darby. Nelson Darby was the guy who created Darbyism and the whole.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. Yep. That created all this Zionist, you know, pre-tribulational rapture. I'll bless them that bless thee, creating this whole entire religious construct that in turn created a political construct to create this whole entire debacle mess that we currently have in the Middle East in a broader sense. And what also creates all of this stress, trauma, and friction now between Christians, right? And it's all based and predominantly it's steeped in Darbyism and in dispensationalism, which is Darbyism. That's fascinating. Yeah. And that's what's so fascinating is all of this stuff interconnects so hand in glove. And it's that's why it's so relevant to current events.
Yeah. And what's going to make this even crazier is when you start looking at what the Plymouth Brethren was after after all is said and done. That's the it's basically a Gnostic, I would even say satanic cult masquerading as Christians. And there are some Christians who are authentically Christian within it. Sure, don't get me wrong.
Sure,
but the way Darby set it up is you have a group of elect that are initiated. And it was in this grouping that Aleister Crowley, the Beast 666, was born into a Plymouth Brethren group.
Yes, both his parents were
Plymouth Brethren.
Wow. Yeah.
And his mom was the one who was obsessed with calling him the Beast 666. And that's where he took it to heart. Because a lot of these... these satanic cults, they really want to give birth to the Antichrist. That's like the thing that'll make you the coolest family in the block is if you can like pump out the Antichrist, you're like everybody will bring their parties, will be in your club.
What in the world?
He just lived up to his mom's expectations really well, and he filled that space. And he also, and you'll find that in the course of digging into some of the controlling, steering hands behind the UFO. PSYOP include many Satanists.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking little guys. I'm talking
Michael Aquino.
Yeah. Temple of Set. Who's directly
L. Ron Hubbard, all these. Yeah.
Yeah. And people might be thinking L. Ron Hubbard, he is the founder of Scientology. That's not Satanism. And it's like, well, no, he was, a disciple of Crowley in the Odoro Templi Orientis, as was Jack Parsons.
Mm-hmm.
And, they were doing like black magic, sex magic, Babylon working stuff in the desert, trying to give birth to the Antichrist too. And L. Ron Hubbard, even admitted that he was the Antichrist, in memo circulated in 1981, from his hand that basically said, yeah, you could interpret, you know, the Book of Revelations as, the second coming period of the Messiah. But in fact, I know, cause he has clairvoyance, cause you know, he's a pure being, having like purified himself with rituals,
purges thetans or whatever.
Yeah. He's like, actually, yeah, that's the feet, not the thetans. He calls it the Markabian order. Will be returning, which is sort of this pseudo-human galactic federation that has been around for 20,000 years, and they're going to come and invade, and that's what the Bible's talking about with the Messiah. So anybody who stops that invasion is actually the Antichrist. So since he's saying, I'm going to stop this invasion of the earth and the body snatchers, you can consider me the Antichrist and his own
son. And the Antichrist is the good guy.
And the Antichrist becomes the good guy all of a sudden.
Yeah, wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's crazy. And,
but his son, Hubbard's son, when asked, because his son broke away from the cult in 1959 and gave an interview to Penthouse Magazine, strange place to give the interview, but he did in 1983. Mm-hmm. And I selected like a little excerpt where he's asked by the interviewer, so what was the religion in your household? And he's like, Satanism. That's all we knew. And, you know.
Wow.
Scientology is essentially, it's harder to see because it's like where satanic rituals often occur within hours or maybe a couple of days. He's like, but in Scientology, my father crafted it so that they're just stretched out over a lifetime with OT. Yeah. Like you've got, as you pointed out, the operating thetan levels of initiation in a kind of a Masonic thing that then transform or designed to reconstruct your nature, your human nature. Into something more free and more liberated, more empowered to have extrasensory perception and other things and interface with these demonic forces or spirit beings, whatever, that then give you the power of mind over matter as you raise up through the rites, right? And he's like, but that's all it is. It's pure Satanism. And my father and the interviewer's like, so you mean your father worshiped Satan? And the son is like, no, you don't understand. He thought he was Satan. You don't worship anybody if you literally believe you're the most powerful being in the universe.
An egomaniac.
Yeah, absolutely. But here's the thing, right? So when you look at things like Tom DeLonge and To the Stars Academy, which is largely behind popularizing a lot of this stuff in film, as well as in, they've got a weird hybrid science film pop culture thing. It was founded this thing by this cardboard cutout, useful young idiot, or not young so much anymore,
punk.
But
punk rocker
Tom DeLonge from Blink 182, who's just this, you know, like pothead, fascinated by occultism, and a burnt out, you know, punk rocker who just couldn't make it anymore. And he was just obsessed his whole life with like reading magazines about UFOs and little books about UFOs. Thought he was like this great, insightful mind who had a personal revelation about how this all plays together as far as government collusion with Roswell 50, 60 years ago. And he's like, and then that's why he gives interviews online. And he's like, that's why I was selected and tapped on the shoulder by the former head of the CIA. And he names all these deep state operators who were like, we recognize you have talent, kid, come with us and help prepare the groundwork for the Great Awakening, using to prepare people's minds. Anyway, his organization, To the Stars Academy for Arts and Science, set up in 2014, was co-founded by the Real Brains, who was this figure, Dr. Gerald Puthoff. Is it Gerald? No, it's not Gerald. Dr. Puthoff. Harold. Hal Puthoff, as he calls himself. Hal Puthoff made it up to the OT-7, operating feet in 7, back in 1971. He worked very closely with... he's the co-founder of this thing, along with a whole slew of very high-level intelligence operatives. Hal Puthoff now plays a key role in the story on several levels. So back in the 70s, he was the driving force with the CIA, working with Jacques Vallée, major figure behind the creation of the internet through his work with the defense DARPA. Back in the late 60s, he was recruited by J. Allen Hynek, who's another big figure behind Project Blue Book and the whole UFO mythos. He was a big teacher of Steven Spielberg as well. He actually is the one who coined ET, extraterrestrials, and the close encounter, or no, the close encounters of the third time, third close encounters of the
third kind, right?
Third kind. That's it. So he's the one who talked about the different kinds of encounters and advised Spielberg on set. So Hynek has been there the whole time. Hynek is the one who trained Vallée. Vallée works with Puthoff. They co-create what's called the Stanford Research Institute's Stargate project to start
astral projection,
scientific veneer using a lot of statistics over remote viewing, killing your enemies with your brain over thousands of
staring at goats,
their hearts explode, but bending spoons with your brain and trying to run through walls with your particles. So a lot of this involves infusions of the use of LSD, mind drugs, things like that, and they get, again, they started publishing what appeared to be scientific studies around this, giving this sort of a normalized, respectable veneer in academia, but also in the military, which was their key target, was to find a way to justify introducing a lot of this material into the military, which had been there, but was still sort of working in the shadows. They wanted to make this more into a dominant position within the military, within things like the various PSYOPs battalions, the first PSYOP group, the second, the third, the fourth. Today, a lot of these PSYOP groups still exist. They still recruit. Their creepy recruitment videos are still on YouTube, where every young person who's nihilistic and into drugs can become all of a sudden a member of the shadow conspiracy as part of the to be good American patriots, which is, anyway, it's messed up. So you have Puthoff, Scientologist, AKA probably pseudo-Satanist. I think he probably is aware when you get up that high in the OTs. Then working with Vallée. Vallée is openly friends with Kenneth Anger, a disciple of Crowley. He described his friendship with Anger, who also toured with the Stones, made satanic videos with a variety of Crowleyites. Kenneth Anger is working with him, but Vallée is also friends with another figure named Anton LaVey. They're hanging out at LaVey's house doing rituals together. And he's got photographs of himself with LaVey saying, oh, I was hanging out for research purposes only. It's like, that was a long time.
Sure,
a long time to spend intimately hanging out with this guy. now, LaVey's close disciple, his lieutenant, is Michael Aquino. Michael Aquino creates a pseudo breakaway foundation from the Church of Satan, which LaVey is running at the time, and that's called the Temple of Set.
Temple of Set.
Now, Aquino cut his teeth in Vietnam, and Vietnam was one of these things that had multiple effects to it, and this is what JFK was trying to stop, right? Because JFK had a whole national security memorandum in place to extract U.S. troops from Vietnam, and to begin a process of ending the Cold War. He had an entente that he put forth as a proposal to the Russians to say, okay, instead of like building nuclear bombs together, like Rand Corporation and these psychopathic CIA analysts are telling you to do, and you've got your own advisors and your own cybernetics cultists who are also promoting a variation of the UFO theme inside of Russia. That was also going on. Because both sides were, there was infiltration on both sides. And he basically said, okay, how about we just let go of this whole idea of killing each other with nuclear bombs. And let's instead work to have a space program together. And he puts out this beautiful speech. People can watch it. It'll be spliced into the videos where he goes to the UN in 1963, about 3 weeks before he's murdered. And he gives this beautiful speech saying, hey, let's transform our weapons of destruction, our technology for destruction, into technology for creation. Let's co-create a space program together and explore the heavens together that are God's creation, created the universe. Let's explore God's creation and find points of common ground as we do so and find our humanity. It's a beautiful speech, beautiful proposition. Khrushchev's son wrote later on that had JFK not been killed, his father, the original Khrushchev, was going to accept. Don't get me wrong, I'm not a fan of Khrushchev in general. I don't like the guy, but it was sabotage, right? And so I say this to add counterpoint, because all of this evil use of looking at the stars and space and seeing either something that is going to kill you, where humans go to get killed by aliens, or something hostile and empty, no one can hear you scream in space. A lot of these motifs that have been amplified in Hollywood it was done to destroy the type of optimistic idea that space is not this place of darkness and cold and lifeless death, but rather our home, as far as being part of the kingdom of creation that is part of the universe that God created, right? So it's a very different philosophy of space that JFK was representing that had to be crushed, because it was awakening too much of the sense of loving humankind and
optimism, right?
Go beyond the limits to growth extend ourselves ever more into the universe by discovering the universe's law and transforming it, right, for the good of mankind. That had to be crushed. So these creeps then go on. They infiltrate. I mentioned Aquino. Aquino is now a colonel working at Fort Bragg, very high level, very close friends with a fellow named John Alexander, Colonel John Alexander, who becomes the popularizer of the whole Mind Wars takeover of the military to bring the battlefield into the mind of the people.
That
involves, a variety of other things to electronic weaponry, space-based beam weapons, things like that were all incorporated into it. Aquino is behind this with Paul Vallée, another figure at Fort Bragg and across the U.S. military, that then creates this more like new agey group that went from the fringe all of a sudden into the mainstream. A lot of these same figures, including Colonel Alexander, work with Harold Puthoff and Vallée in creating what's known as the Discovery Institute for Science. It's an organization in 1994 created by Robert Bigelow, a billionaire real estate magnate, who's still very big today in funding disclosure operations. His operation works closely with To the Stars Academy. And it also works very closely with Lawrence Rockefeller. And I think that's where the big player comes in. And Lawrence Rockefeller died in 2004. But Rockefeller, as I mentioned earlier, is the creator of, he's not just a bankroller behind the human potential movement, the Esalen Institute, the growth of drugs. Like, he funds Terrence McKenna's whole career.
Terrence McKenna. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you your thoughts on that. You know, a lot of these usual suspects like Stephen Greer, and the other guy that's real into McKenna, that talks about, I forget that historical guy that talks about, like, everything's like parallel universes and all this stuff. And, you can, and it's all about LSD and DMT. A lot of these guys
Graham Hancock, right?
Graham Hancock. Graham Hancock. So, like, a lot of these guys have been on Joe Rogan. So there's an inordinate amount of parallel. And then just recently, there's another very popular podcast called The Sean Ryan Show. And he's like, retired military, special forces. And it's real interesting because he's had these government whistleblowers on, right? Like, like who's the guy, Grush or Goosh? The
David Grush.
Grush, yes. So he's had these other whistleblowers on, and they're like for example, the one ex-military guy he had on, they were talking about how they use natural disasters, and he saw this basically experimental aircraft that didn't make any noise, and it came down and like a UFO, and there was black op guys on it, and they abducted children, right? Continuing to create this mythos and tie it into child trafficking so that it makes it even more emotional, right? And then a few episodes later, another thing he's very proactive in is about veterans with PTSD. And there's a gigantic movement using DMT, psilocybin, and all these things as a healing, you know, as a tool and a guide to heal your brain and heal you from PTSD. And I find it very interesting, you know, similar to Rogan, how these very influential podcasts are titrating out this information and simultaneously like linking all this stuff together.
Yeah.
And when you go through your series, I mean, it's all so intricately tied together. It's to me, it's a little bit troubling. But
yeah, it should be. Yeah, that's the correct feeling one should have. Is troubling, at least. Yeah. No, I mean, it's absolute. The direct connection between the creation of a normalized drug movement didn't peter out when MKUltra was made public in the church committee hearings in 1975. I mean, that was when a lot of this stuff that was not supposed to be made generally known was made generally known. And we'd almost forgotten that a lot of this stuff was admitted to by high-level government officials during the church committee hearings. COINTELPRO, the infiltration of civil rights groups, anti-imperial groups by FBI operatives that he would even carry out assassinations of people like Fred Hampton. Malcolm X or Martin Luther King, or I mean, all of these things didn't happen by lone gunmen. This was done, and it was revealed in the 1970s through Senator Frank Church and his subcommittee on assassinations as well. That went through all the so MKUltra didn't disappear at that moment. It just maybe was rebranded, but everything you saw, because I mean, what for those who don't know, what is MKUltra? MKUltra was set up as an outgrowth of a CIA MI6 co-directed project called Project Artichoke in the late 40s that was designed to explore the new breakthroughs in LSD-25. This is what generated DMT, psilocybins. All of this stuff came out of these psychiatrists and chemists working with intelligence agencies, also methamphetamines and stuff, during World War II, even, and this work was being carried out by using the research of people like Aleister Crowley, was a major, not just promoter, but he utilized mescaline in a lot of his magical rites rituals, including his ritual for the Eleusinian Mysteries that he developed in 1910 with the Ordo Templi, or this is right before he joins the OTO, the Ordo Templi Orientis. But he continued this work on mescaline throughout the whole period. It was discovered after World War One that trauma cases, shell shock cases coming out of World War One and trench warfare gave these sick psychiatrists a huge array of human guinea pigs to work on for the first time. Mm. Like when in a normal life would you ever have this many trauma cases? Because you're never supposed to live through something that unnatural is what World War One was. Never should have happened. So all of a sudden they have this huge body of psych cases to work with. And they're like, all of a sudden we're noticing that there's compartmentalization. People's brains are being depatterned through their trauma. Mm. They have memories that are locked away in their subconscious that we can now invoke through certain drugs and prompts. They start doing work on electroshock as well. That also has a role to play. And this becomes something which they really, really advance heavily during World War II when they're trying to create better assassins, people who could stay awake longer, like 3, 4, 5 days to fight. There's a variety of excuses used to test your mind drugs. The Nazis are doing it too, right? Like Hitler is massively addicted to all kinds of methamphetamines, as are many leading SS officers and people on the ground, as just like this practice continues in Ukraine today, where you have these like
better living through science, right? I mean, better living through science, right? That's
well, that's right. Well, that's where trans is. So this then is rebranded after the war for peacetime processes. And so part of it is, well, you know, they discover that, and MK Ultra is the name given to Project Artichoke in 1952-53. And they're like, well, you know, we can use this for the liberation of the people, because part of the problem was people's belief in certain ideas that were artificially making them unwilling to accept certain necessary transformations in the world order, like one world government, the abolishment of the nation state, getting rid of, like, you know, like family was holding people back. You know, that was destructive to the type of conditioning people were children were expected to receive in the state. So they had to, like, get rid of people's attachment to family wisdom, family traditions. The idea of God, your religious community had to be crushed as well, because that was also disrupting the type of conditioning that was needed for the youth. And the state, the idea of the nation, right? Having something that it gives your identity a connection to something much bigger than yourself and your community as far as the nation. And don't get me wrong, there's abuses we've seen that with the Hitler Youth marching down with a very bad expression of a perversion of nationalism, but there's a healthy version that the oligarchy has really been trying to destroy. And the way that they've done that is they've done this dirty type of, like, see, nationalism, Hitler was a nationalist. He believed in nation. And so if there wasn't Hitler believing in nation, if there wasn't nations, there wouldn't have been the war. We could have peace by getting rid of nations. So that's the way they do
and
it.
And if we destroy the nations, we have global citizenry and we're all one. And then we need to be technocratically manipulated by an oligarchy, because, you know, we're global citizens and there really isn't no more individuals. There's no more individuality. There's no more nationalities. It's called a nationality. You know, you can't be a nationality without a nation. And that's the point, right? To just make us all androgynous, Baphometic kind of, you know, non-binary, global citizens.
Yes, exactly. And so, this is the MK Ultra operation, really got it. And again, I mentioned earlier, Sir Henry Tizard, who sets up the whole, like, basis of the Manhattan Project, the idea of building the bomb, the nuclear, using the power of the atom in a way that, because people were talking about using the atom that they'd only recently discovered would certain elements on the periodic table are slowly emitting gamma, alpha, beta waves and transforming into energy. Now, that was discovered a few decades earlier, and most scientists at that time were thinking, well, that's great. How can we use this to end hunger? Like, that's a lot of energy that's locked up into matter. You know, like when Jesus said, like, with this mustard seed, you can move mountains. That's literal. Like, there's actually something to that. You know, like every ounce of matter can transform, if harnessed properly, into a lot of heat and energy to do a lot of work. That's liberating. You could desalinate ocean water and green deserts. Like, that's how people were generally thinking. But then you had the satanic fringe of disciples and followers of people like H.G. Wells, who were much more anti-socialist.
Yeah,
the Fabian socialists, who all despised humanity. And they were like, okay, how can we use this to terrify humanity into and break their will to achieve our political ends? So they're like, let's use it to make a terror device. And so you had a grouping of these freaks, Sir Henry Tizard being one of several, but you had Leo Szilard, who was a leading figure controlling also the Manhattan Project. There's a few. Who went up Oppenheimer, who's being popularized, romanticized in Hollywood nowadays. He was also part of this whole weird Shakti Shiva death cult that really believed in purgative violence and cleansing the earth by some sort of fire that would then allow for the recreation of a new type of human. He believed that and talked about his weird perversion of Vedic philosophy around this it's almost like a rabid theosophy, but something which is effectively Luciferianism anyway, so it makes sense. And he was also behind the idea of building up these terror devices, but then using them. And he celebrated the unnecessary use of the nuclear bombs in 1945 in letters to Truman saying, oh, thank you. Good job. I'm really happy you did that, because now we're going to knock humanity into their senses to accept something new for themselves. So you had all of these creatures, but what are they doing? They're also creating, like Sir Henry Tizard is creating MK Ultra and Naomi Klein in her book, The Shock Doctrine, goes through this meeting with the CIA and some Canadian oligarchs in near where I live at a hotel called the, I forgot it all of a sudden, but this is the founding meeting in 1951 of what became MK Ultra. He's also the head of the Tizard Commission on Flying Saucers. So he's the one who puts the ball into motion in a heavy way to start organizing an international database of flying saucer observations and really focus on the military officials, people working in the Air Force, aerospace, in the military. Really, those were high trophies. If you could get one person who's like high level military to become a believer, and you, all sorts of dirty tricks would be used to give these people the experience that they wanted them to have. Yeah. That's worth more than 10,000 regular plebeians, like normies, who say they believe in UFOs, because that person's word carries a lot more weight. And if you can get like a Mitchell, like an astronaut, or a Harrison Schmitt, like an astronaut, that's worth like a billion normal humans to these guys. So they put a lot of effort into cultivating within the military, within the Air Force, within the scientific establishment, sort of a UFO cult of people who would be really devoted followers. Now, one thing, and we'll get back to MKUltra, one thing that is important is that they were seeing something. People were oftentimes looking out at the night sky and they would see weird, unidentified objects behaving in weird ways. I believe that is absolutely true.
Of course. But yeah.
What were they seeing? What was going on in Area 51 overseen by Richard Bissell? Well, this is where you got to look at, well, what was Germany doing with their three separate aerospace flying saucer projects with people like the Horton brothers, with aerospace engineers like Victor Schauberger? There's a whole slew in Italy had their own flying saucer program utilizing innovative new techniques for using suction technology and implosion technology that is very different from the type of combustion engines and explosion technology that we've tended to use in a lot of our chemical rockets and other things like the V2. It's a different approach to getting flight to occur. Magnets have also been useful in getting certain types of interesting phenomenon, like the elevation of certain very heavy objects. This is all being advanced in a very... I mean, this has been declassified now very clearly. A lot of the blueprints and the prototypes were destroyed in 1944, 45, or especially 45. But a lot of it was absorbed into the U.S. military industrial complex. And because of the Cold War, the idea was, well, now everything is still secret, just like in the Manhattan Project, where no scientist knew what another scientist was doing, right? Every little mini department under Tizard's guidance was highly compartmentalized. So, you know, one grouping of scientists was told to work on boron 263 or something, and another group was told to work on this little device, and only a small executive body who were initiated would have the right to see what the whole system was doing with all of the different branches of Manhattan Project.
Rings of power, right? That's how they do it. They compartmentalize it, decentralize it, and create rings of power. And, you know, you tell some really smart guy, well, when this turns green, push the red button, you know, and he doesn't know that when he pushes the red button, it's going to blow up, you know, downtown Manhattan or whatever, fill in the blank. But, you know, that's how plausible deniability.
That's how this stuff works. And yeah, C.S. Lewis talked about this too, right? The obsession with being in the inner ring, that people would then want to be on the inside club. And you lose your soul sometimes in trying to do that. But that's the way that this cybernetics systems control operation really was put into motion, in controlling the technology of government, especially after the war. And cybernetics became the name given to that new... cybernetics is literally the science of control. That's all. And it has application for things like doing specific acts, like if you're going to shoot down a missile and you need your defense systems which interface with radar. To detect when an incoming missile is happening, you got to know quickly where it's going to go, which trajectory to shoot, so that you're shooting into a future spot where the missile will be. Like that requires a lot of feedback loops into a central command that can calculate quickly, transform it into action and response. That's useful. Okay, fine, for what it is. But what these guys
last, say, oh, except last week when the Iron Dome failed, it, for some reason, even though it's been ironclad and Iron Dome, well, last week it didn't quite work. So, oh well.
Well, then you got, strange, anomalous, failures like that. That's a whole thing to itself. But So what they did is then they said, okay, this thing works so well, we're going to maintain that during in Area 51 in the whole Cold War, where everything now under the Iron Curtain is going to be based upon keeping secrets, not only from our rivals in the other side of the Iron Curtain, but also from our own American people. But occasionally, our American people will look out their night sky and see things that we're testing out, like new drones, new drone tech, new even the flying saucer tech that was being developed by the Nazis. We will be testing that out and people will see it. What do we tell them that they're seeing? Well, this is where it became very interesting that all of the flying saucer observations began in 1947, like right at the earliest days of the Cold War. Why not, why not before that? What happened to all of the pre-World War II flying saucer experiences? It's like it's not really there. They all start just bursting onto the scene just at that time. And so, of course, Henry Tizard is coming out saying, okay, let's get a flying saucer working party. And when you have like somebody without security clearance flying their jet, looking out their window and seeing something weird, you can now get that person when they give their briefing to their commanding officer down on the Air Force base. You could let them know what they really saw, but they're not allowed to talk. And so you start creating a climate of multi-generational testimonials of people who start believing, and they believe so much that they start living it out in Pygmalion fashion manner, right? So they start acting it out. And then
how you rewrite the prior history to 47 is you create this whole like ancient alien concept and you have a thing on like the History Channel with guys with weird hair, and you look at hieroglyphs and say, well, these were really spaceships and all this stuff.
No, exactly. And that brings it exactly. That's always what they wanted. And see, at the end of the day, I came to realize my wife has done a lot of amazing work, and she's actually going to be the one writing the first episode of this new series that we're coming out soon on the Hidden Hand Behind UFOs. She's done a lot of deep dives into the deep occult networks of pre-Christian cultism and how these things transmogrified over the eons, especially in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, into the occultism very much associated with Rosicrucian Freemasonic networks that also gave rise to things like the Bureau of Psychical Research. People like John Dewey were members of the Bureau for Psychical Research. So there's direct connections to Margaret Mead, the leading anthropologist, and her husband, Gregory Bateson, who were also part of this whole weird network of like talking to spirit beings, the undead, other things, or getting messages from like Tibetan wisdom creators that Madame Blavatsky was saying that she was receiving as a channel. All the stuff that was big in the 19th century, it continued on, and a lot of these same figures were working with MK Ultra. Like, so they became the founding operatives around MK Ultra in the new incarnations of parapsychology and other things, Carl Jung being one of many. But then you have again Bateson, who was an MK Ultra controller with Sidney Gottlieb. Margaret Mead, again, I mentioned her, but she's a big one in creating an eco-anthropology, a new type of idea of that was needed to justify eco-colonialism and to convince the people of the world that the true natural state for humanity is to simply be a tribal society like we see in Africa or in the native communities of North America who don't like technology. It's against their culture. It's against their genetics. They're just pure. And so technology is a pollution to the purity of the natural savage. And so people like her who glorified bringing humanity down to the state of like a pure tribal being living, eating bugs and in a decentralized pattern of local tribes. You can see directly how that informed the guiding hand of the Wellesians who were trying to manage this new world order over the Cold War period. Graham Hancock has been a major, I don't know if he even knows. Maybe he doesn't even know what he's a part of. I don't know. Some of these people have no clue. Sure. What they're a part of, they just believe so much and they have a bit of creative energy that they're like bankrolled. Terrence McKenna also believed that you could use this information about aliens that we've been getting to recast, as you just said, the whole human story from like maybe Christ was an alien. Maybe he was, that's how he walked on water. Maybe he was like an initiate of the Eleusinian mysteries. That's what Graham Hancock is also promoting.
Yeah.
Who had, pre psychedelic or pre LSD experiences using like psychedelic plant or wheat rot that when you eat it gives you a bit of a psychedelic trip. Maybe, and that was used. That really was used. That's the way this stuff works. That it's true that that was an initiatory experience for the elect within the cults of Eleusis and Delphi, or Apollo at Delphi, and the various mystery cults of Mithra Mitre and Gaia, which was formerly the cult of Cybele in ancient Rome. They used these types of narcotics and drugs to depattern people's minds, both with one variation, a diffused form for the masses who would go through their, who would have an identity of good hedonistic slaves who would just think their freedom was their ability to have their weekend orgy and otherwise would be happy with their servitude. And the other would be a useful way to initiate those who would become the sociopathic managers controlling the herd. They would have their own set of more special elite experiences with the same drugs ultimately. So that's what they've always been wanting to bring back and recast all of our sacred stories around, this idea that no, it's actually been either aliens from this dimension or maybe aliens from another dimension, which is what Jacques Vallée and Harold Puthoff, when they were working at the Princeton Research Institute, Stanford Research Institute on the Stargate project, they were the ones putting out this idea of the extra dimensional hypothesis, that aliens actually are beings, you know, they would use like this quantum mumbo jumbo crap from like string theory saying, look, mathematical model of the universe says that there's multiverses. So, and first of all, that's garbage. All of these multiverse discussions are all based on a perversion of science that occurred when Max Planck and Einstein died. And these mathematical fetishists who never discovered anything like Niels Bohr and Max Heisenberg and Wolfgang Pauli, they never made a discovery of anything, but they made models that they love,
right,
about this idea that no, since an electron or a photon can't be directly experienced without changing its momentum, you can't know anything, right? They're like, oh, it's both, everything is both a particle and a wave. Everything is kind of everywhere. They built a whole science based on the denial of truth, the denial of causality. And they said, all we can know as scientists is statistical probability, where an electron might be. So it's got like a 90% chance that it might be here, but it's got like a 10% chance or an 8% chance that it might be here. And it's got like a 0.001 pico fraction chance that it might be in Alpha Centauri. But, we'll go with that 90% chance that it's here. And they said, that's all you're allowed to know. So, of course, as soon as you build a new science on the denial of causal principles, which is the way that all science has ever advanced in a positive way, is through the belief and the discovery of causal principles, including Max Planck's work, his work with Madame Curie, Vernadsky, Mendeleev, all of the greatest scientists that we love, whose ideas gave birth to the good explosions of Renaissance movements of progress, they all believed in causal principles in a universe that was made ultimately reasonable and loving and good, and by a creator in whose image they were made. Now, they may not have all believed in the exact same way. Everybody's a person that's a distinct individual, but they all had that sense within themselves, which gave rise to their faith and endurance to make the discoveries that they made and translate them in the face of priesthoods that would want to crush their discoveries because it's disruptive to control systems that have monopolized already existent forms of knowledge, right? Oligarchs don't like new discoveries. But when you can't crush it, what do the oligarchs do? Well, they say, you can't beat them, try to co-opt them. So what they'll say is, we love science, and they'll try to diminish or ice out from the history books of science the person who made the discovery. They'll take the outward shell of the idea called a formula, and they'll say, look, all you need is fruit to fall on your head and you discover gravity just by having like apples. And we'll create this useful cardboard cutout like a Tom DeLonge or an Isaac Newton, who we're going to say is this great mind discovering all this stuff. But when you start digging into like who actually discovered gravity and the inverse square law or the infinitesimal calculus or even Newton's work on optics, like all of these things were already known before Newton, discovered by people who are real scientists before Newton. And all of a sudden the way that they were thinking is like crushed. eliminated, erased, and we're just told the outward formula is all we need to memorize to pass tests and to be good little monkeys in some technocratic, you know, fantasy world.
Yep.
And so these scientists, they don't believe in truth. They started becoming the modern quantum mechanics cosmology, which also embraced a way to describe the founding of the universe 13.7 billion years ago through a big bang that they say occurred because look at redshift. The way they choose to interpret redshift is like, we're choosing to say it's the Doppler effect. And if that's the case, we can relatively do an extrapolation in a linear fashion and calculate when everything was together in some like singularity moment. But then the question became, well, what caused the singularity? How could how could everything come from nothing, right? Be contained. How could everything that exists be contained in nothing with physical limits moving into nothingness? Like, that's a problem. So that what they said is quantum mechanics solves the problem because now we can justify why there are these other unexplorable dimensions, but they work on paper. So we'll say that there's 11 or 12 or 80 dimensions. It doesn't matter. You can always make another dimension and make it fit your model. And somewhere along the way, we'll say like this phenomenon and or some piece of energy that was bouncing around dimensions hitting the same dimension giving birth to like massive spermiation of the universe, right? And everything is slowly spreading out and dying now under this like heat death, inevitable eventual heat death that's animating our entire destiny. And they had to do these mental backflips to get around the simple, already existent, very satisfying explanation that people who are reasonable believed in, which is that we're living in a universe that is created by a creator who is loving and reasonable and made us in his image. And
the other advantage of this singularity is we get to use transhumanism and put the band back together and join the AI and continue the singularity. So that way we go full circle, you know? So we go from the singularity to the singularity. Isn't it great? It's going to be great. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, it went through one irrational blob of like randomness 13.7 billion years ago, and we're going to get right back to one homogenous blob under a technocratic AI elite priesthood managing a new set of gods, a new set of rituals for whatever god you want to, as a traumatized person, because people expect people are going to go through a lot of trauma. That's part of what happens when you have a systemic economic breakdown and or major war, which kind of unfortunately some of these freaks really do believe that it's necessary to have a purgative experience of the earth to really shake us back into our good behavior. So all of a sudden people will be much more inclined to be much more superstitious, find meaning in something. And this, what happened in pure hard science with these statisticians was also done for the origin story around Darwin, right? So Darwin also was very useful in having been promoted by the British Royal Society, again, eugenics, just like they did for Newton. And what it did is it said, okay, random mutations is adequate to explain the emergence of new properties of life. That's sufficient. Darwin says it's random mutations, like the rolling of the dice. Occasionally a new attribute comes out, which is useful to helping you kill your enemies, your rivals, and have more sex and eat more in a world of diminishing returns. And Darwin even admitted that in his autobiography that he got his discovery by reading Thomas Malthus's on the Essays on Population. And he literally says in his own words, like, it was only by reading Malthus who helped me appreciate our struggle for survival in a world of diminishing returns that I now had a mechanism by which to work my theory, which is why the Empire wanted his theory to become normalized. And people like Thomas Huxley, the great
Darwin's bulldog.
Yeah, Darwin was Darwin's bulldog. And he was the guy who did the most, more than Darwin. They didn't let Darwin, just like they didn't let Newton speak in public in general, because they couldn't defend their own theories well. But they needed a Huxley, or they needed, in the case of Newton earlier, it was a Samuel Clarke or a Robert Cook who would go into the public domain and have disputes with a Leibniz or somebody who's a real scientist about why Newton was right. So they always have these handlers, but they need some cardboard cutout. They need somebody to attribute great genius to be like a new godhead, a new secular godhead for their pantheon. So like Darwin, Newton, like today we're told almost to have this irrational awe of these minds who will never come again. And we shouldn't even think about criticizing the thoughts of such great giants. And it's like, no, they're actually useful idiots who were tools within a geopolitical operation. That's all they were.
Yeah. And they were predicated on racism and eugenics, you know? So it's like these guys, you know, like Darwin's, the rest of the title of his book was all about favored races. I mean, he was clearly a racist. He was obviously a eugenicist, and the purpose of his, observations were to prove that his race was superior, which is why they inbred and all that
good stuff. Yeah, exactly. And if anybody has a problem with that, with what you just said, they should just read In Descent, Descent of Man, which Darwin wrote in 1878. And in Descent of Man, he literally says only the stupidest of the races of the earth would allow their dumbest to breed and procreate, criticizing human beings. And then he has a letter to Galton, his cousin, who's really the founder of eugenics, saying, mm-hmm. "You have won me to your cause." And this is a letter that is very well known. And people a lot of people just don't want to look at that because they don't like thinking about the social implications to the. And it's not like it means that you necessarily have to be an absolute, creationist. You don't have to be if you don't like Darwin, because there were already other views of evolution tied to intelligent design, a loving God that existed with American scientists like James Dwight Dana and his theories of cephalization, that there is a directionality to creation, that God created the universe to be made better and to constantly improve, to become more inclined to express beauty, goodness, and truth. And there's a whole variety. I mean, Cuvier, there's so many other scientists that were being destroyed who were making real breakthroughs in why most species that have ever existed no longer exist. And it wasn't because of like human pollution or anything like that, but they believed in intelligent design, in an organized, ordered purposefulness embedded in creation that we can discover through our free will and love of truth. And they don't teach any of that. That's all been crushed. Mm-hmm. And that's the way Huxley like framed his debates. He would pick like some of the, he would say, okay, when we have our big public debates, I'm going to select one of the most fanatic Anglican priests who hates Darwin to be my opponent, who has the most simplistic, naive view of their response, and I'm going to decimate them. But he would never select anybody who was like who's competent in their scientific material. He would never allow that. And that's how he was able to then, they just wielded this use of like sardonic humor and degrading attacks against anybody who doubts anything of the purity of the truth. Anyway, I'm ranting, but you see what they did with the aliens thing now. So they were like, okay, not only do we have this monkeys thing that we all came from, just like random mutations from monkeys, and that's it. We're descended from monkeys. We're not even a creature above monkeys. We like the evolution happened that way, not even that way. That on every level. But now on top of that, we have a new origin story that maybe these super advanced beings took these monkeys and infused them with some of the alien DNA and then made humans. But then there the question comes, now we don't have to have God for another reason. But then it's like, well, what was the process that gave rise to the aliens? If you're saying that they also came from another planet, that planet had life before the aliens, and that there's like some evolution that you're saying is happening on that planet. Did that planet have another older alien sect that did a hybrid technology on them? And what about that alien sect? Did they also have like,
yeah.
So you got this infinite reductio ad absurdum, mm-hmm. Which again can resolve so easily if you just let go of this need for randomness and aliens or monkeys or something, and just look at maybe the universe doesn't have external limits. Maybe something can't come from nothing. Maybe the idea of the naive before and after that we get in the material world, where there was a time before I was born, a time after I will die, the time before my phone was made and after it'll be destroyed. Maybe these material properties of limits in physical space and time are something which it would be hubristic and maybe naively wrong for me to try to extrapolate that onto the everything of the whole universe. Maybe the universe as a whole doesn't abide by these types of constraints, right? And maybe there wasn't a time before which there was nothing and after which there will be nothing and outside of which there is nothing. Maybe that doesn't even exist. Maybe there's another way of looking at the redshift or the blue shift of other galaxies, which is not the Doppler effect. Maybe there's another reasonable way of seeing that, because it's true. There are red and blue shifts, but what if there's another reason for that, that might have something to do with the physical space time of those different galaxies that have to do with their age and less so their distance or speed that they're moving away from the point of observation, which is true actually. And there's people like Halton Arp, who is a great scientist who was witch hunted for his work on his Atlas of Peculiar Galaxies in the late 60s, when he was looking at these. He had the Cambridge telescope that he was in charge of. He got fired for his work because he was like, well, look at all of these different galaxies that we can find that have like very different redshifts, indicating that they're like thousands of light years away from each other, but they're all connected by these filamentary fragments. But how could they be so connected physically, but separated by thousands of light years? It's impossible. Mm-hmm. Maybe the differentiation of redshifts and the coexistence of these quasars, which we're told are the furthest of the entities from the Earth because they have the highest redshift, which are often found in a high density fashion inside the filamentary structures of these adjacent galaxies. Maybe he's like, well, perhaps they're being born. Maybe what we're seeing is actually more of like a differentiation or a birth of galaxies. Because even today, like, there's no satisfying explanation for where do suns come from. We say that there's a billion or billions of suns in our Milky Way. What creates a sun? Well, we're told by these modern scientists that it's from black holes, that black holes are in each galaxy. It's a black hole. Well, by definition, you can't observe it. And outside of each galaxy, between the galaxies, we're told it's just dark matter and dark energy, which makes up 95% of the universe. That, by definition, you can't look at it. It's like these other dimensions. You know, there's 12 dimensions in string theory, or 17. By definition, you can't investigate it. So why have we created all of these mental cages of places the mind is not allowed to go ontologically to explain the universe? Maybe there's maybe we could break down the cages and relook at the universe from a much more reasonable, harmonic, in a harmonic way that explains things in a way that doesn't involve supernatural entities or anything like that. Or, you know, or like, it's the same thing for the UFOs thing. People see UFOs. Okay. They've seen UFOs. Can we find an explanation that doesn't require we have alien, like other beings from other dimensions doing this or interfacing with our government officials who found aliens that could travel the speed of light to get here, but then couldn't like navigate and crash in Roswell? Like all of a sudden they just forgot how to like fly their super fast ship and one of them survived and has been giving their tech to us, and that's how we have a space program. Like the level of this all works, I think, because people partially, yeah, there's the drug culture.
yeah.
People are very cynical as well, right? Like they've just been so used to being lied to about everything, which is where it gets at your original observation. Like why release all of the stuff about the working with Nazis after World War II? The Nazis never lost the war in that sense. And MK Ultra. And then all of a sudden also the UFO disclosure thing. Why at the same time? Because they're trying to diffuse the danger of these truths becoming used by citizens who are patriotic and who want to actually fight the devil, fight evil, and use this evidence of truth in such a manner that these are weapons that are useful in the battle, and instead have it all tainted by shape-shifting lizard people and stuff like that, that then really removes the danger of these things being used well. So you have Joe Rogan or David Icke or others speaking about a lot of truth.
Yeah.
But it's useless at this point. If at the end of the day, you're thinking, well, my David Icke says at the end of the day, my survival is based on me feeling good and putting out good vibes because the shape-shifting lizard people want to ultimately suck my fear energy. And that's all they want is me to be afraid. And if I could just be not afraid and loving and good, not even be good, just put out loving vibes.
A good vibe,
I will destroy the lizard people who want to create global warming because the lizards like warmer climate. And that's what David Icke said. Joe Rogan's like, all you need to do is like, you know, liberate yourself and do what the man didn't want you to do with the war on drugs by accessing your higher freedom with DMT. Yeah. And everybody's told we have microaggressions, right? So we've been microaggressed, so we're micro-traumatized. So we need micro drugs, or what do they call it?
Microdose.
Yeah, microdosing.
Yeah.
That's what we should all be, to just deal and be normal people. And it's... And so, of course, people are inclined to want to believe in aliens.
And this all comes full circle, and it's all interrelated with all the psychological operations, one, that have been perpetrated in the past, what are currently being perpetrated, which is why I think this is such critical information. How about we take a break now and show your trailer?
So that would be great.
People can kind of get a taste for, let me make sure I back this up. All right, here we go.
There's footage and records of objects in the skies that we don't know exactly what they are.
I was informed in the course of my official duties of a multi-decade UAP crash retrieval and reverse engineering program.
There's somebody at a very high level that closed the door, looked me in the eye, and says, okay, I'm going to introduce you to somebody.
They can protect the higher echelon against detection. They can serve as a means of effecting communication.
All right, so there you go, y'all. And what we'll do as well is we'll put the links in the show notes. And Matt, right now you're trying to crowdfund or crowdsource to finish the documentary?
Yeah, it's under construction right now. So what was going to be a very short little film has become, from what I've talked about, impossible to say in a short time. So we're making it a series of episodes. It might be 6 episodes. It might be 5 episodes. It might be 10 episodes. I really don't know how long it's going to take to tell a story in an artful way, but the episode one is under production right now. And yeah, we are crowdfunding. If people want to do a donation to help this process out, I would request that people go to CanadianPatriot.org, and there's a support section. There's little like donor box information where people could either do one of the pre-existent, you know, $10, $5, $10, $50 options, or make your own customized thing. Each one is going to cost about $3,000 to $5,000. So it's going to be, they're, you know, 30 minute videos. It's going to be complex. So anybody who wants to help, it would be highly appreciated. Also, risingtidefoundation.net. We're doing another series of videos that my wife is Cynthia Chung is leading on why there are no limits to growth. The first one is already out on escaping Calypso's Island on, what is this green delusion that especially young people have been fed in schools. And so that's going to be about 6 episodes to get through that story, and that risingtidefoundation.net, people can go there. And if they want to support that, it's good, especially for homeschoolers, people who want to really prove on a deep way why the idea of overpopulation is a complete fraud on every level. And green energy is a total genocidal fraud, scientific fraud. Can't work, was designed not to work. That video series is going to tackle that question.
Wow, so you're doing a lot of great work, and I love it because we homeschool, you know, so we're always looking for good information. And at a minimum, I want information that at least has analyzed and look at both sides of the conversation, or maybe not even both sides, since it's not always a Hegelian proposition, but maybe all sides of the historical artifacts, and then draws conclusions, or maybe just sets the table so that you can draw your own conclusions. But yeah, I really appreciate a lot of your work, and I'm very thankful that you took the time here to inform and educate us. Everyone got to see that you're obviously very knowledgeable, very passionate, And I appreciate you wanting to put out quality information that is not biased by some type of propaganda machine. And this way, as a in a sense of informed consent, we can be well informed of what is going on in this inordinate psychological operation that either is going to force us into World War III or force us to all band together as global citizens to fight off some nefarious intergalactic second coming of transpermia or whatever. I don't even know what's going to happen. but what I do know is that we're all being conned. And the only way to operate outside of fear, you know, and we call this the Fearless Podcast, and, you know, we're Christian. So the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. We're not saying to not fear God, right? We're saying that to fearlessly speak the truth. And that's why I like having awesome guests on that are very well educated and can kind of present their information in a clear, cohesive way, speak with parhesia, all the things that I'm not good at. I want to have guests on that have kind of ironed all that stuff out. But Matt, thank you so much for taking the time and investing it here. All y'all, check out the links below if you want to support any of these projects. For all you homeschoolers out there, check this out. It's a great place for resource.
Thank you so much. And I would say for those who don't necessarily have resources, because, you know, we sell books, we've written a lot of books, Clash of the Two Americas that I co-wrote with my wife, volume 1-4, as well as the Untold History of Canada book series that we've written. My wife's done something as well on the deep origins of fascism. Like, I'm talking deep. If you don't necessarily have the resources to buy these things, which are available on YouTube, on our websites, send me an email and I'll send you free PDFs of them.
Wow.
That's Canadian Patriot 1776 @ tutanota.com. So tutanota, it's like a German encrypted email service, but so it's tutanota.com. And send me an email, request them. I totally understand. Times are tough. I'll send you free PDFs.
Wow, that's awesome. Thanks a lot. And so if I can remember, I'll put that email down below.
Sure.
So Matt's the one that does that. So that's why I say, if I can remember, and then I look at him. But man, Matt, thanks so much for your time. And you got any parting questions or anything that you want to interject?
No, I think it was really good. And I was just listening the whole time.
He was absorbing it.
Absorbing all the information.
That's great. Yeah. That's why we do this. Well, thanks, cool. Everybody. Hey, this is a value for value proposition. If you do love and appreciate what we do and the information that we provide, please go to thetexasboys.com. And if there's anything you need there, teas, coffees, honey, whatever you need, check us out. If you're local and need some beef and pork, we'll be opening that very soon.
Very soon, yeah.
And lastly, my last recommendation that I can give you all is stay fearless, my friends.